The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
Today on the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt, brought to you in partnership with the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy. The Senate Judiciary Committee holds confirmation hearings for Judge Ketanji Brown Jackson.
I can't answer in the abstract.
Is the trafficking of heroin laced with fentanyl really a victimless crime? We'll hear from a member of the committee, Arkansas Senator Tom Cotton.
There are many Americans who no longer feel safe today. Parents are scared to walk down the streets that used to be free from crime.
And did Judge Jackson go easy on a convicted criminal in a child porn case?
I remember in that particular case, I considered it to be unusual.
And as Putin wages his brutal war in Ukraine, there are signs that the superpower, Russia, may be getting set back on its heels.
It's the fact that they're not recovering their dead.
This has always been, but now it's particularly clear. This is Putin's war. We'll get perspective from a Russian immigrant. Carol Markowitz of the New York Post.
There were people in Russia as late as last week who had not heard of the war.
All this and more. I'm Hugh Hewitt. Great to be with you. Catch my program each weekday morning live, 6 to 9 a.m. Eastern Time and on demand 24/7. Learn more at HughHewitt.com. And follow me on Twitter, at Hugh Hewitt. Follow this program as well at Town Hall Review. We begin in our nation's capital in the confirmation hearings this week for the president's Supreme Court nominee, D.C. Circuit Judge Ketanji Brown Jackson. There's little doubt in the final result. Judge Jackson will almost certainly be confirmed to fill the seat being vacated by the veteran liberal justice Stephen Breyer. But the hearings before the Senate Judiciary Committee did reveal some serious concerns for any senator who was on the fence, and the conclusion that the liberal Breyer will be replaced with the leftist Brown Jackson. Arkansas Senator Tom Cotton pressed Judge Brown Jackson on her sentence reduction for a man convicted of trafficking heroin laced with fentanyl. Senator Cotton is a regular on my program. I reached out to him after the second day's hearing.
I thought that my exchange with Judge Jackson, specifically the exchange about the drug kingpin, Keith Young, whom she sentenced and then re-sentenced, was very telling. It goes to show that she's soft on crime. She's an activist who has spent her entire year advocating on behalf of criminals, trying to seek weaker sentences and weaker criminal laws for them. Let me just lay out what happened in Keith Young's case. This man was a career criminal. He had had multiple convictions. He came in front of her court in 2018. He faced a 20-year mandatory minimum for having heroin laced with fentanyl in a home where he had his own children. The judge expressed her frustration that she had to impose a mandatory minimum. She even apologized to this drug kingpin that she had to impose the mandatory minimum. Well, fast forward 2 years to 2020. Keith Young comes back to her court, and he has filed, under the First Step Act, something called a motion for compassionate release. That means immediate release to you. It was for elderly and terminally ill inmates. Keith Young was neither of those, and I'll give her this. She denied the motion for compassionate early release. He was not eligible for it under the First Step Act. But then, Hugh, she took it a step further. She transformed that into a motion to reduce his sentence under the First Step Act by 7.5 years. And, Hugh, the law that she cited was not retroactive. It was specifically not made retroactive by Congress. Yet she felt it was unfair that he had a 20-year sentence because he was sentenced before the First Step Act, and others who committed the same crime got a shorter sentence after the First Step Act.
Yeah, Senator, if I understand correctly,
rewrote the law.
If I understand, it's a sua sponte motion on her part. If you move to reduce on the basis of compassion and that's rejected as she did, then there's no motion before the court. So she is doing it on her own initiative. Am I correct?
Yes, Hugh, because she said, and she, remember, in 2018, she expressed her frustration that she had to sentence this fentanyl kingpin to 20 years. She apologized to him. And then 2 years later, she gleefully celebrated that he was back in front of her as if it was a first sentencing. And rather, she did not give him the compassionate release. Remember, Hugh, that's an immediate release from prison, an immediate right. release from prison for elderly and terminally ill inmates. He obviously did not qualify that, and she did not give it to him. But she converted it, sua sponte, of her own accord, to a motion to reduce the sentence years from now by 7.5 years, because for 2 years she had pouted that she didn't, that she had to give him a 20-year mandatory minimum. It goes to show that she is an activist on behalf of hardened criminals, and she always has been.
Now, you know, I listen to these things very closely as a con law professor, and that just struck me, that she had to do that ab initio on her own initiative, sua sponte. And the other one, you know, when Mike Lee starts talking about the Dormant Commerce Clause, I might be the only person in America who's listening. But the other exchange was Senator Cruz on critical race theory. What is a Georgetown Day School board member supposed to do if not know what's in the curriculum, Senator?
Well, you would think that the board members of any private school would be reviewing the curriculum, especially things that are highly controversial, like critical race theory. You know, liberals like Judge Jackson have been saying for years, like, oh, this is a graduate school and law school seminar theory, and it's not exposed to children. That's funny, because charlatans like Ibram X. Kendi, who have gotten famous and wealthy peddling such racist nonsense, have books out entitled How to Be an Anti-Racist Baby. Obviously, the far left is trying to indoctrinate children down to kindergarten to hate America and to judge each other by the color of their skin, not the content of their character, as Dr. Martin Luther King had it. And Judge Jackson was totally oblivious that this was happening at her school. And she has, in fact, cited in the past that she relies on critical race theory as she goes forward in sentencing, because she thinks it's such a fascinating combination of things like criminal law, administrative law, and critical race theory. So her answers yesterday about critical race theory were simply not credible. Hugh, the only thing that I'm raising are what concerns every American in the middle of a crime wave, that Joe Biden and the Democratic Party have been releasing hundreds of thousands of violent and serious felons from prison, that they want to eliminate the bail system so violent felons don't even stay in, that they want to reduce sentences so future convicts don't go to trial so much, that they want to defund the police, that they nominate judges like Judge Jackson to the courts that apologize to child pornographers and fentanyl kingpins for having to sentence them to longer sentences than they desire. For every mom and dad who's worried about their kid walking to school and facing crime or overdosing on drugs, or worried about the quality of their public parks and you have criminals hanging around them, I think yesterday was very eye-opening for the kinds of judges
that
Joe Biden has been nominating, not just this judge in the Supreme Court, but on down to every court in America. And I think the American people are going to express their dissatisfaction with the Democrats' soft on crime policies this November.
I'll admit it. Before this week of hearings, I told my radio audience repeatedly the judge could have received as many as 65 votes for the confirmation. Now I think she'll be below 53. Who knows? The over-under is, though, 53. The other soft-on-crime case that caught my attention was Senator Hawley's questioning of Judge Brown Jackson on a child porn case. Let me encourage you. Don't let your little ones listen to this next segment.
Is he a victim? Is that your view here? Is that why you said this?
I turned to Byron York of the Washington Examiner. I can't believe she said that. What did you think of the rest of that hearing and that exchange?
Yeah, that was a stunning moment. The idea that fentanyl distribution is a victimless crime was just astonishing. And you're right, it's common in cases to bring in some victims' rights groups that will speak generally about you know, the cost of one or another sort of crime. You know, I have to say, looking politically at this, it's difficult to watch the whole hearings without thinking, this is a done deal. I mean, it's just a done deal. It was a done deal going in. Democrats are absolutely, totally united behind this nomination. We've often talked about how in a 50-50 Senate, they have to be completely united, and they have to have the vice president's vote. Well, they're completely united on this one, and they are going to get a few Republican votes. By the way, I thought you did. I thought you just said that you thought maybe Romney was going to peel off because of the
child pornography.
the child pornography thing. You may be right. There's a quote in the Washington Post this morning where they apparently approached him, and the reporters approached him in the hall about the sentencing guidelines discussion, and he said, quote, "It struck me that it was off course, meaning the attacks were off course that came from some, and there is no there there." So,
well, you know, I didn't think it was going to fly either. I was mostly concerned with her CRT answers and what she thinks about her duty as a Georgetown Day School board member. And I hope Ted Cruz returns to that. I thought it was kind of a soft on crime political messaging. But that's actually mind boggling to me as a lawyer. And I worked on the first sentencing guidelines as a clerk for Judge McKinnon in 1984 when they were mandatory. A three month sentence, Byron. Isn't that astonishing?
3 months, yeah. Can I make a comment about the press here, which is interesting, which is the White House has been pushing this idea that Senator Hawley, by bringing up this topic, is tapping into QAnon.
I saw that.
QAnon. Well, the White House is doing this, I mean, with a straight face, okay? So in the Washington Post, they reported that the White House was doing it. It's not clear how many other Republicans in coming days will be eager to join his line of attack, which the White House suggested was intended to resonate with QAnon conspiracy theorists. Okay, so the Washington Post at least does us the favor of saying this is a White House thing. The New York Times, in its analysis of this, Republicans contended that the nominee had been especially lenient on purveyors of child sexual abuse imagery, a claim that spoke to a fixation of those wedded to the QAnon conspiracy theories. Many of its followers, some of whom took note online of the Republican line of questioning at the hearings, falsely believe that former President Donald Trump is fighting a cabal of elites, including top Democrats, who are, in fact, child traffickers and pedophiles. The New York Times just gives us this, doesn't say that this is some ridiculous White House charge or mud they're throwing at Josh Hawley. But that's the level of White House defense on this issue.
What an absurd, by the way, I don't care what the New York Times says or my paper, the Post, reports or doesn't report. The American people will hear that colloquy with Josh Hawley and they will raise their eyebrows about KBJ because they don't think an 18-year-old in the possession of 8-year-old rape videos ought to get 3 months in jail. And they think he deserves a sex offender designation and is probably troubled.
Yeah, and it's certainly a legitimate line
Absolutely.
Of discussion. I mean, you may take, you know, Andy McCarthy's position on this, which is fine, but it's a legitimate area to be discussed in a confirmation hearing. By the way, as the judge pointed out several times, it has to do with things she did as a judge.
Coming up, Putin's brutal war and his demoralized army.
Is the fact that they're not recovering their dead.
General Jack Keane, the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt returns in a moment.
Grounded in our distinctive Great Books curriculum, the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy prepares students for exciting careers in politics who understand the relevance of America's founding principles to today's policy challenges. From our Southern California campus, we've sent over 1,000 alumni across America and around the world. The application period for fall 2022 classes has begun. Find out more at pepperdine.edu/SPP. That's pepperdine.edu/SPP.
Welcome back to the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt. We're at a month now since Russia's dictator, Vladimir Putin, ordered the unprovoked invasion of Ukraine. At the time, the question was how long Ukraine might fight before they eventually succumb to Russia's military might. Ukraine is defying the odds, and the world is inspired, and they're cheering for Ukraine. But can Ukraine win? Who knows? But they are changing the equation, to be sure. I turn to retired Army General Jack Keane.
They've taken considerably higher casualties than they expected. And in addition to that, the performance of their ground forces just hasn't even measured up. I mean, there's obvious indications of low morale. One of the significant indicators of that, is the fact that they're not recovering their dead. And I don't know anything that would make their forces actually have problems performing than that indicator. The other thing is there's a number of combat refusals going on. One of the reasons why there are reported deaths among generals and regimental commanders would be at the colonel level is because of the combat refusals that's taken place inside their ranks. And the fact that these leaders have to go get down on the ground and force them into combat is part of what has taken place. And so the low-level reserves who are not well-trained as an indication of just how significant the problems are that the deployed force in Ukraine is certainly having. They're also calling up a number of youngsters, conscripted youngsters in Russia, and many young people are just fleeing throughout Europe because they want to avoid the conscription. And if they're going to put them into the fight as well with very little training, they're going to become nothing more than cannon fodder. And it gives you a sense of how desperate they are.
Has he already lost the ability to win this war? He might be able to destroy cities, but has he lost the ability to subdue the countryside in the way that we eventually subdued Iraq and the areas in the first part of the Afghan war that we were successful in?
Yeah, he's lost. I mean, what we believe at the Institute for the Study of War, that is that his initial political objective and why he was conducting the military campaign to accomplish that objective was to topple the regime and change out to a pro-Russian Ukrainian government. And that's not going to happen.
Has there been any indication, General, of an organized Ukrainian counterattack? I really don't know what your opinion of the Ukrainian high command is. They are certainly holding on and fighting bravely, but do they have the ability to organize any kind of strategic counterattack to separate one column from another or further drive the Russians backwards?
I don't believe the Ukrainians have that capability, you.
Okay. Now, do they have the capability to attack the Black Sea maritime assets that Putin has been using to bombard from the sea, Mariupol and other parts of the southern coast?
They do not, because they don't have anti-ship missiles, which is something they've requested from us, and we have not given them. For the life of me, I do not understand it. It doesn't make any sense. The Biden administration has never had this right, you. I mean, they've been selective about providing weapons to the Ukrainians. They get it in their head that some weapons are offensive and some are defensive. Look at Russia invades Ukraine. Every weapon that the Ukrainians are using is a defensive weapon at that point. Everything. For some reason, they've absolutely misconstrued this. They keep being afraid and paralyzed by the fear of escalation.
What do you think we should be watching for as an indication that Putin may be about to give up the ghost and realize that his sunk costs, he's got to cut and run?
I think we're a far cry from that. I think he's determined, based on what I see outside of Kyiv. He's dug in his artillery. They can't take Kyiv, but they're not leaving either.
Last week, Russia held a pro-war rally in their national stadium in Moscow. The event marked the anniversary of the annexation of Crimea, but it was in reality a propaganda event that harkened back to the days of the Soviet Union. How are the Russian people sorting through Putin's war? My colleague Kevin McCullough turned to a Russian immigrant who had been pleading, "Don't place blame or shame on Russians that belong squarely to Putin." Carol Markowitz joined Kevin on AM 970 The Answer in New York City.
A lot of it's very confusing to people.
Well, the largest Russian-speaking community in New York is the Ukrainian community. And
right.
I didn't know that
right.
until the war broke out. But that surprised me. And I think that is an example of why it's very important to be thoughtful about how you're reacting to the events of what's going on.
That's right. And I think until the war broke out, that Ukrainian community, if you're talking about the one in Brooklyn, would describe themselves as Russian. I always said my Russian community in Brooklyn, even though most of the people were not from Russia. I was born in Russia, but that was very rare. Most of the people were born in all the different republics of the Soviet Union and had never even stepped foot in Russia. And Brighton Beach is called Little Odessa, which is a city in Ukraine, but people refer to themselves as Russian. So, you know, I saw this becoming a problem in the first few days of the war, where Russian speakers were talking about their kids being bullied in school or their business being targeted for, you know, either nasty phone calls or just a decline in business the way Russian Tea Room or Ruski Samovar in Manhattan are experiencing.
Right.
So it's been really sad to watch because even the Russians in Russia don't have any control over Putin's actions. This is not a free country. These are not free people. They can't, you know, protest in the street without getting arrested. So we can't, like, look at what's happening over there through our own free people prism. Yeah, if it was our country that suddenly invaded, you know, Canada, we'd be in the streets. We would do something. We would write to our elected officials. We would have them do something. But that's not the case in Russia, and we have to just stop pretending that other countries are like us.
Well, give me just a second to drill down on this for a bit. What is your best sense of what is happening in Russia by way of information of what is going on? Because I've reported from this microphone over the last number of weeks how the Russian government, the Federation government, has tried to literally shut off any idea of what the outside world has to say about this. Mm-hmm. But is that working? Are there still information channels getting through to Russian people? Because I know that there's been thousands that have protested, and I'm guessing that many of them are now in gulags.
That's right. Most of them are in jail. There were people in Russia as late as last week who had not heard of the war. I can tell you that. And it's not that crazy. It's a very vast country. Not everybody has access to any information, let alone information that Putin doesn't want them to have. So a lot of the Russian people, I think, are getting this one-sided story. The story is that Ukraine was full of Nazis and Russia is basically there to root them out. And if you look at, you know, Russian history and the World War II, where they fought the Nazis, it becomes like, oh, okay, well, I guess there's Nazis there and we have to go fight them again. And this is real. This is really what people are believing there. This is what they're being told by Russian TV.
I've seen some of those same talking points, Carol, here in America amongst right-wing people in America. Why is that narrative being told here?
Well, I think that there's, you know, just like any rumor might have some basis in truth, I think Ukraine did have some Nazi issues over the last decade. I think there are white supremacist Nazi groups there. I absolutely. But are they why Putin invaded? Absolutely not. That's ridiculous. And there's nothing of that sort at all. Putin absolutely invaded because there was the concern that that Ukraine was becoming too close to the West and he wanted to pull them closer to him.
Coming up, was communism imposed on the Russian people or did it well up from the Russian people?
A deeper look at the Russian plan when the Town Hall Review returns in a moment.
Hi, it's Mike Gallagher. I start every day by reading through the stories at Daybreak Insider. In just 10 minutes, I can zip through 10 stories that help me start my day and help shape where I go with the Mike Gallagher Show. Over 250,000 people get Daybreak Insider by email daily, and it's available to you at no cost. Go to daybreakinsider.com and simply plug in your email. That's daybreakinsider.com. In 5 minutes, you will be the most informed person in the office. That's daybreakinsider.com.
Welcome back to the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt, brought to you in partnership with our sponsor, the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy. Two Salem radio hosts, Dennis Prager and Sebastian Gorka, are uniquely qualified to discuss the long-term aggressive effort of Putin to essentially reassemble the Soviet Union. Dennis studied communism in college and has spent decades lecturing on the Soviet Union. Dr. Gorka was born to Hungarian parents and lived in the country for much of his early adulthood and worked for the Hungarian Ministry of Defense. The western border of Ukraine, about 85 miles of it, is Hungary's. It is a border that is now flooded with refugees. Sebastian Gorka recently sat down for a lengthy interview with Dennis Prager.
Dennis, you are supremely qualified to help us understand what Churchill once called a riddle wrapped in a mystery inside an enigma. For those who aren't familiar with the way you spent your early 20s, will you tell us what you did as a young man during the height of the Cold War?
I was in my very early 20s. I was a graduate student at Columbia University at the School of International Affairs, and it had a number of affiliated institutes, Russian Institute, Middle East Institute, East Asian Institute, African Institute. I was a member of Middle East and Russian. I studied Russian, and on a visit to Israel, my third year in college, so it's even before that, I was asked by someone I knew, an Israeli friend, would I be prepared to be sent into the Soviet Union to smuggle in religious items to Jews, because they were not allowed to have them, like Christians were not, and to smuggle out the names of Jews who wanted to leave. And they thought that I would be the ideal candidate, being an American, so I'd be somewhat protected by my passport, and knowing Hebrew and Russian. So I was sent for a month, and it was obviously a tense month. I was followed most of the time.
Where did you travel in Russia, in the Soviet Union?
Moscow, what was called then Leningrad, which is back again to St. Petersburg, and then Baku, Azerbaijan. The first Westerner to visit the synagogue there in decades. It was literally underground. And the stories, I'm not going to get into now, but it obviously they were life-forming. What the effect that it had to see a young Western Jew who knew the religion and who could, I was always called up to do something to show my knowledge of the liturgy. Because they had been told that the Jews of the Soviet Union were told that Judaism is dead. And they shouldn't even bother thinking about it because Jews outside of the Soviet Union no longer practice it and have assimilated. And here I am, 21 years old, and I'm able to lead the prayers and read from the Torah. And it people gathered around me. I'll just tell you one story.
Please.
So in Leningrad, I made a very big impact that I could do all this stuff. People just stared in amazement. And I have the chills telling you the story. These are not stories I tell easily because they were very emotionally powerful. Anyway, so listen, the reason I'm telling you is the denouement of all of this. I'll tell you exactly. 35 years later, on a trip with my listeners on the Baltic, we went to St. Petersburg, and two couples, friends of mine, went with me to that same synagogue that at 21 years of age I had led the prayers. And I walked in, and a man looked at me, and he goes, "You're the kid. You're the kid." You have to understand, this was 35 years later. I didn't look at all the same. I had white hair. And he goes, "You're the kid." And I just, all I could say was, all I could do was hug him, that he remembered that kid.
Dennis, that's a beautiful story, and we could spend the rest of the show just discussing your trips behind the Iron Curtain. Could you help? Because now it's as if the Cold War never happened. There are generations who think that a KGB colonel can become some great champion of the West and Christianity. Can you give a little bit of insight into why Russia is different, its liminal position on the Eurasian continent, and this concept of whether it's Peter the Great, whether it's the Tsars or the Secretaries General, why the great man or the strong man concept still has such sway amongst the Russian people?
So you've really asked the 64,000 ruble question. I have been torn on this issue much of my life. Was communism imposed on the Russian people, or did it well up from the Russian people?
Coming up,
most Russians look at Stalin positively.
More of Sebastian Gorka with Dennis Prager. The Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt returns in a moment.
Grounded in our distinctive Great Books curriculum, the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy prepares students for exciting careers in politics who understand the relevance of America's founding principles to today's policy challenges. From our Southern California campus, we've sent over 1,000 alumni across America and around the world. The application period for fall 2022 classes has begun. Find out more at pepperdine.edu/SPP. That's pepperdine.edu/SPP.
Welcome back to the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt. As Sebastian Gorka and Dennis Prager finished the last segment, they were evaluating the long history of communism in Russia and how that has impacted their society. As the world watches the war in Ukraine, the brutality, the willingness to target civilians, many ask, what kind of people could do such a thing? The conversation between Gorka and Prager continues as they discuss the troubling lack of moral clarity.
This is a debate that people who study Russia and the Soviet Union have had for decades. In other words, is there a Russian proclivity to tyranny, or was tyranny imposed on them? I mean, it's not critical, but it is not insignificant as well that Stalin was not Russian. Stalin was Georgian.
Yes.
So it's an interesting fact. I don't know if it's dispositive. I was of the belief, despite the fact that their whole past was czars, which is tyranny, nevertheless, there were real movements toward what we used to call liberalism in Russia under the czars. And there was Dostoevsky, of course, and there was Pushkin, and there was Tchaikovsky, and so on. So you start to think, gee, had there not been the imposition of communism, then the Russians might have developed in a much more open society way. I was of that belief through much of my life. However, I have changed because of the popularity of Putin, and even more telling, from every poll, most Russians look at Stalin positively.
Incredible.
That incredible is the perfect description, Sebastian, because he murdered 20 to 40 million of their fellow citizens.
Including at least 6 million Ukrainians, which I think...
I talk about the Holodomor all the time. Why people don't know about it.
Look, I never thought that what my parents experienced, tanks on the streets of a nation's capital, in the case of my parents, it was Budapest, I thought that was ancient history. That was what our parents, our grandparents had to suffer through. It's happening right now as we speak in Europe. And I am shocked by the lack of moral clarity on the conservative side. I'm a little bit surprised by how suddenly liberals hate Russia, which wasn't the case from Durante on down for about 70 years. But when we have people who say they're conservatives, Dennis, who say, well, you know what? This was provoked by the West, bioweapons labs, Nazi genocide. Putin is encircled by NATO. And by the way, he's a champion of the West and Christendom. How did that happen in less than 30 years since the dissolution of the Soviet Union and the Warsaw Pact that we've completely lost moral clarity?
Look, you're speaking to a kindred spirit, and my lament about the loss of moral clarity has been my life's work. I frankly don't have an answer. The man has led the decimation of a country, of an independent country that in no way, shape, or form threatened it. It is as blatant an example of international aggression as one can have. He doesn't believe that Ukraine has a right to exist. It never existed in his view. It was always part of Russia. And there are conservatives who agree with him, yeah, or find that sympathetic. That is why you have to ask in life, what is your standard of judgment? What is your yardstick? And my yardstick is moral. That is the first question I always ask. Is it right or is it wrong? So, for example, I believe totally in America first. But I don't believe in America only. America only is not conservative. America first is conservative, but not America only. God or nature or luck or our ingenuity, whatever you wish to ascribe it to, has made us the strongest nation on earth. People look to us when they are invaded by bad guys. Isn't that a good thing that they look to us? Why would we want to shirk that responsibility and say only if New York or San Francisco is attacked should it concern us?
And when you see one of the responses that I received every single day since the war started, and I said the Ukrainians are the party that has been aggrieved and aggressed, is this idea that Putin is an anti-globalist, whatever that means, Dennis. Could you address that? In some perverse sense, bombing hospitals is somehow attacking Klaus Schwab and the World Economic Forum.
Well, look, Hitler was anti-communist. Communism is a mass murder machine. That is all it is. It is nothing else but a mass murder machine and a system of pure totalitarian tyranny. But that doesn't justify Hitler. I don't know why people can't chew gum and walk at the same time morally. The Klaus Schwab and the World Economic Forum is an enemy of liberty. And what Putin did in the Ukraine is pure evil. I don't know why you can't say both.
So you have no theory as to why we have people on allegedly our side who are saying that our sympathies should lie with the former KGB camp? Because I remember a time not too long ago, Dennis, when all conservatives thought that KGB colonels were bad guys who were actually persecuting Christians, not representatives of Christendom.
That was the factor that led me away from the Democratic Party. It only happened under Reagan, but it was in high school that I realized there's something wrong with the left, that they can't hold anti-communism to be the only moral stance one can have vis-a-vis communism. People who don't see evil are a problem. And since you and I are both Bible-oriented, the Bible-based, I want to tell people my favorite line in the Bible is in Psalms. Those of you who love God must hate evil. It is a command. Hebrew has a command form. We don't have one in English. And in the command form is hate. You must hate evil if you love God.
Coming up.
Liberty is not a natural yearning in the human species. It is a value.
The final segment of the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt when we return.
Hi, I'm Georgine Rice. This week in the Christian Outlook, sponsored by the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy. Supreme Court nominee Judge Jackson is pressed on her judicial philosophy. Senator Ben Sasse.
You've told me in private that you don't have a judicial philosophy yet.
We'll take a closer look with Albert Mohler.
She says she doesn't have one. She does have one, otherwise she could not operate as a judge.
And a look at the originalist understanding of the Constitution.
That's very much like textualism. The words say what they mean what they say.
We'll get a look at what's happening in Ukraine today.
Russia is the Hobbesian nightmare for the European continent right now.
And we'll consider how this Hobbesian nightmare gave birth to John Locke.
The way to produce a stable and just society is through government by consent of the governed.
Be sure to join us and visit our website at christianoutlook.com.
Welcome back to the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt. The people of Ukraine are fighting for something too few in the world seem to understand today, freedom. And a recent poll found a sizable percentage of Americans, a majority among younger adults, would not be willing to fight for their freedom. If push came to shove, many said they would flee. What we're seeing in Ukraine is a hunger for freedom, a willingness by people to put their own lives at risk rather than live under the thumb of a new dictator in Vladimir Putin. Dennis Prager and Sebastian Gorka return for the final segment.
Dennis, will you explain to us why this exegetical work has relevance, talks to the moral challenge of what we are witnessing on the Eurasian continent today?
Well, there's the obvious issue that it celebrates the liberation of a people from slavery.
Yes.
So it's unfortunately as germane as ever. But I want to point out something that I point out in the book that is exactly deals with an issue you raised with me last segment. So you were talking about your baggage of being the child of people suffered, whose t- terribly under communism in Hungary, and which saw Russian tanks in Budapest in 1956. And now there are Russian tanks in Ukraine in 2022. So there is a line in this ancient text. In every generation, they arise to annihilate us. Someone arises to annihilate the Jews. And I deal with that question, is how did they know this 1,800 years ago? And it's still true. It's amazing. You know, we went from Hitler to Khomeini and then Khamenei. So your question, I just realized, you can almost say in every generation, there are Russian tanks in some city.
Yeah. And as Ronald Reagan taught us, the extinction of liberty is always but one generation away, Dennis.
God, is that true? And that is leads to another one of my realizations in the recent past. Liberty is not a natural yearning in the human species. It is a value. People yearn.
Can I interrupt you here? I mean, this is what should have been so obvious, I thought, to the neoconservatives who said that we're going to go to war to liberate people because everybody shares our love of liberty, Dennis. How asinine is that?
Well, it's naive. Look, half of America doesn't yearn to be free.
Yeah.
Forget abroad. Half of America, like the rest of humanity, yearns to be taken care of. And that is the opposite of free. The more you're taken care of, the less free you are. That's definitional. And yet people are totally okay with that. You pay my child care. You pay my kids' lunches and breakfasts. You pay my school bill. You pay my college tuition. You pay my health care, and I'll still be free?
Thank you for joining us for the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt. Catch up on earlier episodes at our website, townhallreview.com, and sign up for a daily dose of the best in talk radio. Special thanks to executive producer Russell Schubin, producer Charlie Richards, David Pushon, Michael Cook, Harley Eide, Alex Brad, Adam Ramsey, Ben Brigman, and Dwayne Patterson. Let me say thanks once again to our sponsor, the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy. I'm Hugh Hewitt. Thank you for joining.
Three-star general Michael J. Flynn, head of the Pentagon Intelligence Agency, knew all the government's dirty secrets.
He was one of the most respected generals in the military.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to. He understood its funding.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
The explosive new documentary, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, and covers the facts behind this scandal.
Flynn told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire.
I find out the worst enemy that I'm going to face in my life is right here in America. They took my assessment and they wanted me to change it. And I was like, I'm not changing it.
They had to get rid of Flynn.
With in-depth interviews, archival footage, and never-before-seen personal records of the man behind the headlines.
I just felt like I was drowning.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.